when we left the session yesterday, a couple of us sort of tailed along behind chatting, and when we got over to the dining hall, it was full. And one of the women in the group had a small child who had gone in and turned up two chairs, or three chairs, for mommy and daddy and himself. And when mother finally arrived, he went in and somebody had turned those chairs down and sat on them. And this little guy must be about four, and he was absolutely devastated, and there was a great deal of negative feeling produced by this situation. And it was so perfect because I said to her, now's your chance to practice what we talked about yesterday. So, I think I forgot to signal the girl to start. I wonder if she started. It was just beautiful because she did exactly what we talked about yesterday. First of all, number one, hear the feelings. And she listened while he told her what had happened to him. And the second thing was to be empathic about it, empathetic with him. And she said to him, you know, that really felt rotten, didn't it? You know, that really feels awful. And you saved those for me, and I came late, and now we can't use them. And he said, yeah. And the other gal that had been in the group here yesterday was standing and said, just look at that, because he was like this when he came out. And you could just see his body relax as she echoed his feelings back to him and accepted them. I just wished that everybody in the session had been standing there watching, because it was a perfect example of what we were talking about. So then she went on to then the third step, limit behavior and give a substitute. That, you know, let's think about what we could do now instead, since we can't eat now. Well, you know, he really wanted to eat and eat now, but it was impossible. So then he had some other ideas, and I want to lead into that today, because one of the neat things that you can do to avoid discipline, and I guess maybe that's what I'd like to title this session, is how do you live with kids so you can avoid discipline? One of the neat things you can do is to help them to find alternatives to the behavior. And when you do that, you've got a learning situation. And we'll talk more about that as the session moves on. I often wonder why, especially Christian parents, worry so much about how they're going to discipline children instead of worrying about how they can live with children in a manner that precludes all this discipline being necessary. If you think about it, who likes to be disciplined? And I don't know how many of you work in an office or a job someplace where there's occasionally disciplinary action. Does that feel good? You know, how does it make you feel? How does it make you react? Think about a situation in your own childhood where someone disciplined you severely, took away a privilege or punished you somehow. How did that feel to you, and what did that do between your relationship to that person and communications? Now, very often people say, well, you know, I respected my father more and that kind of thing. I guess I had parents that were on two sides of the fence, so I can reflect on one type of discipline over against another and have some strong biases. One of the ways that today's session fits in with the first one is that your own self-esteem, or I should say ours, because I have plenty of need to deal with this myself. One of the main things that is involved in our choice of the way we choose to deal with children's discretions is our own self-esteem. People who feel good about themselves and feel secure about who they are able to trust children and to trust their decisions and to see them as people that are making mistakes and that need guidance. People who have low self-esteem, on the other hand, are feel that the child is out to get them. And indeed, children can be trained to have that mentality, to have that point of view. But I would hope that one doesn't live with one's own children with that kind of give and take. If that's happening, it's the adult who has started it, because kids don't come into the world out to get you. They come into the world totally dependent on you. And if you can take the point of view, we're both on the same side, the kid's side. Now, why did you have that kid in the first place? Well, sometimes kids come and we didn't expect them and didn't choose to have them. But when they're there, they're helpless and dependent, and they're not out to get you at all. They really are far too egocentric when they are young children to be out to get anybody. So when young children misbehave, they do it because that is the way they have found to get their needs met. And I find in the preschool situation that I bet 95% of children's misbehavior is a learned behavior in an attempt to get their gut-level need for attention met. It is much better to get, and you said this yesterday on the way over, it is much better to get negative attention than no attention at all. At least you're being looked at. At least you count enough for someone to look at you. So if parents have very low self-esteem and feel insecure about who they are, they tend to go to either extreme in parenting. And sometimes they swing back and forth. I very often find that in parents that I work with. They may be very laissez-faire and not give the child much guidance at all. And you've probably known kids in your neighborhood that were perfect little brats who had this sort of parent. Nobody cared. Nobody paid any attention. And if they were running around breaking things, somebody's immediately thought of an example in her neighborhood. You have somebody that... They're not much fun to have around, are they? Yeah. We had some neighbor kids like, oh, I told you about them the other day, the ones that were throwing the stones, you see. They had learned that. Well, when you throw stones, somebody looks. They really look, especially if you can crack somebody's head with it. Then you really get looked at. You know, and that unfortunately feels more comfortable than being ignored. So this is one of the choices that parents make. The other choice is to go to the opposite extreme and feel the necessity to control children completely. And this is that old pecking order kind of thing. How many of you are familiar with chickens? We have a few people here that have lived with chickens. Well, chickens are, you can even watch it with birds. If you have a bird feeder, you can see this happening. And it's interesting to watch because there will be one bird that wants the whole bit and won't let any other birds come along. And it works like a pyramid. Let me put it on the board. There's a bird at the top, or a chicken. That bird can peck on every bird in the whole chicken yard. And then there may be two chickens that can peck on all the ones underneath it, but can't peck on this one. And then maybe there are four or five down here who can peck on all the rest, but not on these three. And it works its way down like that until it's sort of, I guess it's more like a diamond maybe than a pyramid. Finally, it ends down at the bottom with one poor little chicken that everybody in the flock can pick on. Everybody above him can peck on that chicken. And when you look in a chicken yard, I don't think people keep chicken yards like that very much anymore, like they did when I was a kid. You know, they put them out in a fenced enclosure and the farmer goes out and throws grain. Now they've got all these things where you push a button and the grain goes around like this. And the poor chickens never see the light of day, but they have light bulbs. Wish somebody would have swatted that fly. Narnia, where are you? Keeps wanting to walk in my face. Anyway, the top chicken does not get pecked on by anybody, you see. The bottom chicken gets pecked on by everybody. And in between, you get pecked on by the people above, the chickens above you, but not the ones below you. And this works with human beings too, and you think about that. This has been one of the old traditional familial patterns, that father is at the top of the pecking order. And he can give everybody orders and tell everybody what they're going to do. And sometimes this is true even with the extended family in the old peasant setup. And I'm sure it's true in tribes and things. Oh, look at the godfather, you know, what he said went. And all the people underneath him, all the way down, had to do what he said.
That's the basic premise for basic training.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
This is your example. Don't do like him.
Mm-hmm. He's the one that's out, and he's never going to get promoted. He'll be passed over every time. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Well, this works in families, too. In fact, when I first started to college and took my first psychology course, the teacher, Dr. Lawrence Schaff, told about looking out his kitchen window one time and seeing the kids in the backyard and playing. And that the oldest child had just been chewed out by mother because he had neglected some duty or other. He went out and slapped the next kid, who then hit the next kid, and it worked its way down to the two-year-old, who went over and kicked the dog. So, you know, if you're the two-year-old, you're usually the bottom of the heap in the family, and everybody else can tell you what to do, and you can't tell anybody what to do anymore. Okay, this kind of thing has been a culturally accepted form of familial discipline. I'm sure you recognize it well. I mean, I was raised on this, and I think a lot of us were, that what father said went, and it was up to mother, who is in the second line, to carry it out with the underlings. You know, in a family, there are probably three levels, but there may be four or five, depending on how the kids stack up. Kids may not come on a level at all. It may stack by age, or it may stack by personality and strong.
Mother sometimes ends on the bottom, too.
Mother sometimes ends on the bottom. That's right, as time goes on. When the kids are little, she may be up, but she may sink as the kids take precedence, especially male kids in the old system, because they were going to do what the father, follow in the father's footsteps.
And she becomes a doormat.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
In
some families, the mother is the top one, and the father is what we call henpecked, and that's exactly where that term came from, because the pecking order is something that came out of, that is very, very obvious in birds, especially in the chicken yard, and that's where we got that term. Well, okay, this has not proved in this modern age to be a very helpful way for children to be raised, because you can imagine that if you spend the bulk of your growing years on the lower end of this pecking order, you do not learn to be responsible for your own thinking and for your own decision making and your own behavior. Somebody else is always responsible because they tell you what to do. So the reason that authoritarianism went out of vogue very badly for a while was that it was quite obvious that it wasn't working too well in a democratic system. It worked fine back in the old days when everything was autocratic and there was a king in charge. But, you know, having a president in charge is a different thing, because we choose the president from inside the diamond somewhere. You see, he doesn't assume that power through any, God-given or inherited kind of right. He's chosen because of an ability, it says here in fine print. Then we spend the next 4 or 8 years debating that. So the authoritarian way of raising kids went very badly out of vogue for a while, and it was not replaced very well. It was sort of replaced with over-permissiveness. And then people began to see that when you don't have any rules and you don't define any limits, well, kids are still foundering. Because what happens when you bring children up on either extreme of the spectrum is that they also come up with low self-esteem. The child who lives in a highly authoritarian family where he's always being told what he should do and is never in on the decision making or is never asked to make any decisions for which he is responsible, is that he does not learn how to do this, and he also doesn't feel he's very important. Someone else is always more important. But on the other hand, at the opposite extreme, the child also doesn't feel very important because nobody cares. You see, no one cares to help me. Now, the reason for neither of those extremes working too well is because for some reason or other, the good Lord made us with some urge inside of us to have some control. And if you'll notice the way things are set up, and if you read the Bible from kiver to kiver kind of carefully, God gives us this kind of control of our own lives. I mean, he sets forth some rules, but then what does he do about us keeping them? You know, we are not forced to keep those Ten Commandments or Christ's two commissions. We're taught how, and we blow it all the time. And are we then, you know, shoved immediately into hellfire and damnation? No, only if we won't accept grace and forgiveness. So, you know, the whole concept on either end of the spectrum does not hit me personally as being very biblical at all. There's a whole strata of society that insist that they're Christian, and there are people like Bill Gothard out there that are teaching us that the old authoritarian system is the correct way and that it comes directly from God himself. I don't believe that, and I don't find that in my Bible. So, you know, you will have to decide which you choose, but I want to give you my point of view. I like the middle of the road thing much better because I think that it is a post-Christian way of raising kids. It is the way Christ told us to love one another as he loves us. He doesn't love us in a non-forgiving way that says, you are bad, you are wrong, you know, go to hell. He says, I came here to forgive you and to save. I came here for the sick. I came to help you. I came to heal you. And maybe that's some clue to parents You know, kids come into the world maybe sort of amoral. They don't, of course, we are, as Lutherans are supposed to believe in original sin and so on. But when you get a kid in the beginning, it's a little bit blank. And, you know, then you get this imprinting on it. You model for this child. And this child has all sorts of experiences which you have more or less control over. And the older it gets, the less control you have. That's why you need to work very hard at building self-esteem and establishing good communication when the child is very young, because by the time they get to be the age of this one, sitting here beside mother, if the communication isn't established, it's really hard to do it. It's not too late, but it's really hard. And it's very easy at the beginning. Okay, let's talk about the middle of the road then, having now said that I don't care for either end of the spectrum. I think when you raise a child from the middle of the road perspective, it's more a feeling of cooperating rather than one of obedience. And I had a parent say to me one time, I asked the question, you know, why do you discipline your child? And it came out that, well, we want the child to learn to obey. And this woman's answer was, I want the child to learn to obey me so that he learns to obey God. You know, that one just really blew my mind. The difference between me and God is so blatant that the thought wouldn't occur to me that there'd be any connection between the child learning to obey me and learning to obey God. God doesn't make mistakes. I do. You know, now that my kids are all in their 20s, I look back and I see so many things I wish I'd have done differently. You know, so many times that I wish I had known a better way of doing it. I wonder if God ever says that, you know, or if he's all-knowing and he knows what's best for us all the time. You know, that may be one reason for asking children to obey. But nobody likes to obey somebody else. You know, I mean, this is another human being asking you to obey. Now, when you ask a child to cooperate and you respect the child, he probably will obey. But, you know, if you have tons and tons of rules and the child is always having to think, shall I obey these rules or, you know, what's the rule for this? It makes it more and more difficult to obey. If the rules are levied without the child's input and irrelevant to the child's needs, then it becomes even more of a struggle to get the child to obey. Okay, so let me ask you a question. Do you think we need rules when we're dealing with children? Yeah, you're all nodding your heads. Anybody think we don't need any rules at all? No? Okay. I agree with that. Why do you think we need rules? Why do we need rules when we're living in a group? Sure. We need rules like when there's a red light, you stop. What would happen if we just all bombed down the street 55 miles an hour and came to intersections and just whammed on through? Sometimes that happens. I told you about our neighbor whose youngster was killed by a hit-and-run driver. That's exactly what happened. He came to a place where he should have stopped, and he didn't stop. He just wailed on through, and there happened to be someone in the way. That's right. That was last year, or not last year. I wasn't here last year. 3 years ago when I did this session, one of the women said, well, I'm 36 years old. I think I know a thing more than this three-year-old. And that's the clue. You've lived longer, and you've had more experiences, and you also have a level of thinking that is more highly developed than a three-year-old or even a 10-year-old. And even sometimes 16-year-olds whose thinking abilities are on the same par with parents now. They're in the same, you know, range of thinking abilities, but they haven't had the experiences. You know, why is it that there's so many more accidents in the 16 to 25-year-old age range? It's not because they aren't physically capable of driving a car. They're very capable. In fact, they're probably more capable than the people in my age range are with our bifocals and our slowed-down responses. I remember one time somebody turned in front of our car, and my 18-year-old son was driving, and my gosh, he was into a gas station just like that. That car would have hit me. If I'd been at the wheel, we would have had an accident, because I simply wouldn't have reacted that quickly. But, you know, he was just like that. Well, he's in an age where his responses are a lot quicker. So physically, you know, more capable of driving the car, but mentally haven't had the experience to maybe have the discretion that you do when you get older. I've even seen this change in my kids, and you're probably all witnessing it too, those of you that are dealing with grown-up kids.
But they also need the opportunity to make mistakes so they get the experience.
Okay, when does that opportunity begin? That's a really good point.
It should begin very young.
It should begin very, very young, shouldn't it?
We'd like to protect them and not let them do that.
That's right. That's right. There are two reasons why we don't let kids make mistakes. One is because we love them so much and we want to protect them, and we don't want them to have to experience pain. And that's a real strong and beautiful maternal urge. The other one is that we've got ego involved, and when the kid makes a mistake, it reflects badly on me. And the neighbors are looking, and my mother-in-law is looking. Yeah, I mean, especially if grandma's there. Somebody told me yesterday that she really has been out on edge because she's here with her mother-in-law. And the kid is, is that one of you told me that? I think you're very right. That gets us in a lot of trouble with youth and cuts off the communication because we don't appreciate that with each other.
But how many people even let a 2-year-old spill water without just going into tears? I've lived with parents and 2-year-olds for 4 years, and boy, the kid spills the juice. The mother just goes into hysterics.
It's insane, isn't it?
And we're all set up for 2-year-olds so that theoretically there should be no real issue.
I had a neighbor, a woman, and I always listened to neighbors when I had my my preschool, because sometimes you got really good clues that helped you understand where this child was coming from. And I never, responded to the neighbor, but I always listened. And one time a neighbor told me that Andy's mommy, when Andy spilled juice, that Andy's mommy went in the bathroom and took a tranquilizer. Now that's extreme, but this... Yes, this was so upsetting to her, and this was such an over-permissive mommy that the children, I had all three of them, and they got progressively worse and worse until finally with the third one, I did ask them to remove that child from the school and put her into a special school for children with behavior problems. I mean, she needed a one-to-one situation, and I couldn't do that for her. I had 20 other children to deal with, and this child took 100% time. Even extreme behavior mod techniques, which I think are okay as long as you only use them for classroom management and you do get around to finding out why the kid's behaving like this.
But,
okay, that assumes that you're taking a perspective of using children's mistakes as for growth, and that's another point on my outline for middle-of-the-road parenting. If you use children's mistakes to further their growth rather than reasons for punishment, then you help children to grow, and you also help them with carryover. One of the problems with punishing everything the child does wrong is that the child learns to hide that from you, doesn't he? Do you remember ever being punished harshly by somebody that you then didn't ever, you hid your discretions later on? Because it feels too rotten to be punished. I like to talk about fences. Sometimes I call them boxes, but I think a fence is maybe a little easier to understand. Or maybe a playpen. When a child's a little bitty, you put them in a playpen. But how long do you keep them in a playpen? You put them in a playpen to keep them safe. Psychologists are telling us that's not a very cognitively oriented environment for kids, meaning that they need more mental stimulation than a playpen will provide. So, you need to use a playpen with discretion when you've got to go scrub the floor or answer the doorbell or something. It's handy to have one so you know that an awake toddler is indeed safe. But, how long would you keep a child in a playpen? What would happen to a 5-year-old, for instance, who was kept in a playpen all day?
Yeah, right. Assuming the child had any impetus. If they'd been kept in a playpen 4 or 5 years, they'd probably just stay there.
Mm-hmm. They wouldn't know any other world.
They wouldn't have any stimulation to grow.
Yeah, and what would happen to that child?
Taking outside that playpen.
He'd fall apart. Yeah, he would become mentally retarded in there, wouldn't he? And yet we put barriers around kids' lives, like the parents she's talking about that don't let a 2-year-old experiment with pouring water. I used to give the 8- and 10-month-old a glass in the bathtub and, not put the stopper in, but just let the water run. ecologically, that probably wasn't such a great thing to do, but it was a great way for him to learn to pour, and he'd pour and pour and pour, and he'd learn to drink out of a cup himself that way. And it didn't do any damage to anything. But you can do that outside in warm weather, or you can do it in the bathtub, fix up someplace that kids have water play. In the nursery school, we use water play all the time, and nobody thinks anything of it, but you provide for it. You put an absorbent rug under this table that holds water, and you can do this with a dishpan at home, or the baby bathtub the child outgrew. Or you can buy a little swimming pool at the end of the season. I got one for 50 cents one year, and a father made some folding legs for it so we could just shove it in behind something when we weren't using it. And then you put a plastic apron on the kid. And if you're short on plastic aprons, take a plastic garbage can liner and turn it upside down and cut a hole for the neck and arms. And the child stays dry, but he's doing something that he needs to do to grow. And it's also saying to him, you're really a nifty person. Look at all these marvelous things you can do. So,
I think children feel more secure if they're within boundaries.
Of course they do. Of course they do. The over-permissive parent or teacher sets no boundaries, and the child doesn't know what's happening. Sometimes what parents do is to set boundaries very strictly, and then they don't pay any attention to the kid. And so then the kid breaks the boundary in order to have some attention paid to them. There are other parents that I've worked with who don't set any limits at all, no boundaries. The kids just do whatever they want. And then when they do something that's wrong, the parent suddenly swings to the opposite end of the spectrum and gives a spanking. Now the kid is really confused. He's gotten mixed messages. You know, you can do anything you want, you can't do anything you want. And he doesn't know where to go. And what's early?
And what's early? Because 10 o'clock or 1 o'clock, depending on what they're doing.
Sure, 2 is still early, isn't it? No, that's early in the morning.
The kid can say that.
That's right, and you've brought up another really good point that if you're taking notes, put this one down. She said you work it out with them. When do you start working out limits, these limits with a kid?
Preschool.
At 3. How about at birth? What's your limit with a newborn? You know, the newborns, we're very good at allowing newborns to set their own limits. We just do that automatically. I don't know what the point is where we stop letting children make their own decisions. You know, a newborn comes into the world, when does he come? The day you want him? Not unless you have a cesarean section, and then it's usually at the doctor's discretion, not yours anyway. He arrives when he chooses. Now, some kids are very nice about that. I was one of those kids. My father was a minister. He came home on Easter Sunday night, and he said to my mother, well, mother, Lent is over, now you can have your baby. And I arrived the next day. On schedule. You know, I was listening in there. Oh, thank God, my dad has time for me to come now. Okay, that's, you know, we're very good about this. When does a newborn eat? When you decide? No, if you're, you know, there was a period when newborns were made to eat when the adult decided. You were taught that in the hospital. That was in my brother's era. My brother is what now, 58. And my mother said she was told in the hospital that she had to put this child on a 4-hour schedule. My God, how many babies have you had that could last on a 4-hour schedule? I had none. My first one ate every 2.5 hours, day and night, for 6 weeks. I was a shred, let me tell you. I mean, day and night, 2.5 hours. Now, what if I had tried to keep him on a 4-hour schedule? But his birth weight was multiplying so fast. It was just incredible. In fact, we had the health nurse come in. Hi. The health nurse come in when he was 6 weeks old, the public health nurse, and weigh him. And we said, well, you know, how much is a newborn supposed to weigh? Because, you know, the book had said 7 or 8 ounces in a week's time. We said, well, he's gaining 7 or 8 ounces a day. And she said, oh, yes, uh-huh. You know, and she looked at our brand new Detecto scale that was a shower gift, and she said, yes, sure, uh-huh. And she thought there's something wrong with their scale, these, you know, brand new parents. So she got out her little fish scale and she put him on. I can still see her. She had one of these very honest Polish peasant faces, and she was sort of gloating, you know, picked the baby up and was hanging from his diaper on her little fish scale, and she went, because he was gaining 7 or 8 ounces a day. And I am here to tell you, with my eyelids propped up with toothpicks, It took a lot of calories to get that kid to grow that fast. But, you know, that was his schedule. And I was taught, you let him keep his schedule. If you don't, you don't know what to do with a kid. He sleeps on his schedule and he eats on his schedule. Now, there was a period we went through where babies were weighed before and after nursing. So you knew how many ounces they drank. Now, what on earth good that did you? I don't know. But, you know, it's really easier to nurse a baby because you don't know how many ounces he's drinking. If he goes back to sleep, you feel good and he feels good. But we've got a body, you think, oh, he didn't drink the whole bottle. What am I going to do? Well, you're going to do nothing because he's satisfied. And if he drank the whole bottle and he's still screaming and going, you know that you have to do something else. And I had one of those, too. So, you know, we're very good about that with newborns. But somewhere along the line, we suddenly feel like we know how the kid is supposed to eat and how he's supposed to sleep and so on. Well, where do we get that information? If you're still getting it from the child, then you're okay. And then you're setting the limits by indications. How many hours does this child need to sleep? When does he get put to bed? I've had mothers say to me, listen, I need my evening. He goes to bed because I need him out of the way. Well, that's great. Mother has a need. And maybe you're going to have to decide, if you're a parent, that there got to be priorities of needs. And if the kid's priority comes ahead of yours, maybe you're going to have to set yours aside for a little bit. Now, that may sound very harsh, but I really believe that. I think mothers have rights, too. And I think there was a day and age, very popular when I was a young mother, that mothers had no rights, and that the thing to do when you were a mother was to sacrifice all to the child. What this did was to bring up very selfish children who were very insensitive to the needs of others, because mother never said, hey honey, could you tone that down? I've got a splitting headache. You see, mother just grinned and bore it because the child should be able to do, you know, he needed to practice his violin now, and it didn't matter that he'd only been taking for 6 months and it was just dragging me up the walls. We had one cellist, one violinist, one oboist. You should have heard a beginning oboist when you had a splitting headache. Okay, so, you know, the limits need to be set by the child's direction. And that doesn't mean that you don't set the limits, because very often a kid will want to go beyond those limits. Anne, where's Anne? She told me a neat story the other night when they came in here, and I asked her if I could use her as an example. your little one. She said they wanted the whole family to go to Sunday night service together. That's very lovely. But Jeffrey gets tired, and he's like very many people. When he gets tired, he gets owly, right? You know, any of you like that? I won't ask you to raise your hands, but very many of us get very irritable when it's time to go to bed and we can't go to bed. But they took Jeffrey to church anyway. And it said finally she had to get up and take him out because he was just beside himself. And then she scolded him, and then realized, this is my fault. You know, he showed every indication that he needed to be put to bed. And I'm the one in charge and should have put him to bed at his limits, not at our lovely desire to have the whole group in church together at Holden Village on Sunday night. What a lovely feeling. It wasn't a lovely feeling for Jeffrey at all, right? Okay, I don't mean to embarrass you, Chris, but that's such a terrific example of exactly what I'm saying here. You know, if you set limits according to the child's needs and the child experience level, then you're going to have a happy child.